This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress in the studios of the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're here with Carol Muldow, visiting from Santa Fe with her most recent book. It's titled Go Figure, and here's Carol.
Thank you, Grace. Such a pleasure to be here with you. I thought I'd start with the title poem, Go Figure. In her and her and her, I saw myself. In carved sandstone, a voluptuary, my neck coiled to face my back twisted to pinch and raise for an inspection, a small patch of almost out-of-reach skin. One foot planted, the other on toe, my toes on a narrow ledge high up the temple's facade. I'm unfazed by gaze of mason, acolyte, or tourist. And in her, also slightly coiled, rising out of the bath under a painter's gaze, I saw myself stepping over the tub's rim sideways into the easel like a towel. You call me by the painter's name. A Lautrec, a Degas. Myself in veined marble, my towel now draped like a veil, or etched in a notched crosshatch illusion of fishnets, hewn in block and paneled in canvas, versions sketched, filmed, celluloid, digitized. Countless iterations find me poised as if alone at the mirror, examining eye, lip, brow, brush and palette in hand. The mirror goes back to grit, a sand that can't reflect but absorbs the noon sun I peer up into, as into a museum's directed and calculated light, as into a church's perpetual dusk, cinema's blackout velvet.
Carol Muldow, and I'm glad you read that poem first, because it has a lot of your reoccurring themes in that one poem.
Yes.
Your love of art, this prism we call reality, you enter that in the poem. There, your various points of view, so that you look at things from several angles. Mm. And that is in a lot of your work. So I'm so happy you broke the ice with that. Why did you title the book Go Figure?
Well, I loved the different meanings and intonations of the meaning. There's the kind of go figure as in shrug, you know, go figure, and also figure it out yourself, because I don't, even though I think my poems are very readable on the surface, I don't like to have them explain themselves exactly. And then there's a lot, as you mentioned, of figurative art in my poetry. And figuration and configuration. Mm. So I felt that title sort of miraculously covered many bases.
And it's a little sassy.
Yes.
And so you're a little got all of you in that. So we're going to see about other points of view with the next poem, which is about art.
Yes. And this is called Painter and Model 1, because there's another Painter and Model poem in the book. And this is after Lucian Freud's painting, Painter and Model. And I just want to say that the model in the painting is the painter Celia Paul. And I was very interested in her, and she's written two beautiful memoirs. I think one is called Self-Portrait, and the first one. And I was quite interested and related to the duality that she's experienced, you know, both being a painter and being she's quite well known and famous now, but, you know, when she was young, she was a model for Lucian Freud, who was the father of her child. So anyway, all those complexities really interested me, mainly from the point of view of a woman artist.
Mm.
So Painter and Model 1. Because she paints barefoot, she's barefoot in his painting of her painting. Well, not painting, but modeling for him as the painter she is, and gazing toward her ostensible model, splayed nude on a battered brown leather Chesterfield. Well, not gazing, her eyes, as he painted them, are downcast, the lids closed. If they were open, it seems by the bowing of her head that she'd be looking at the model's out-thrust knee. Though what the viewer notices first and foremost is what the paintbrush idling between her clasped hands is angled toward, the model's resting, uncut cock. Both her inner and his outer gaze are ambiguous, distanced, his attending somewhere beyond the painting he's in, perhaps focused on the back of the canvas being painted as he lies there, or on the fanatical painter, not her, standing at his side, who he did, in fact, model for, but the one outside the frame, who positioned, checked, repositioned them both, on and on, just so, or beyond him, and in a reverie of the imagined future, unto us, our scrutiny. Akimbo, one knee rests on the couch's pockmarked back, while the other extends over its edge, the weight of his heel on the floor, his curled toes pointing toward the same heap of squeezed-out paint tubes and crisscrossing brushes that her right foot is on the periphery of, her toes pressing on a tube that's oozing olive green. To me, this, a bottom left-center tangent made by the intersection of lines each set of toes invisibly extends, is the painting's not-so-secret heart. Her smock dress, used as her paint rag, is its own action painting. The cornered walls, a fresco's undercoat.
That is fascinating to me, why you chose that painting, because it is very vivid, it's very raw,
yeah,
and exact. I mean, here we have a male model splayed, and a female painter and a male model. Quite the reverse from what we're used to, right?
Right, being painted by a male painter.
Exactly.
Yeah, so.
But the point is that he does have the female predominant.
Yes.
And the male as supplicant, this way. Mm-hmm. And it is so interesting that what Lucian Freud did in color, you did in words.
Thank you.
The expressionism and the realism and the exactitude. So I'm not surprised that you like his art. It's precise.
It is.
And it's shocking.
It's precise, shocking, expressive. I do like and admire his art. I was drawn to that, though, because of Celia Paul.
And not only that, but the composition you saw in it with her feet and the pointed feet and that little stripe you put in of your own. But, you know, she had one of his children?
Yes.
Somebody had other people had 14 more.
Something like that. I thought it was 13 altogether.
No, he had 15.
Oh, 15.
Yeah, he was quite busy.
He was.
But this is making him more memorable to me than I had known before. It's funny how you made it more of an indent on me with that painting than I had ever thought of
before. Oh, that's wonderful.
And you say every poem and every painting is a self-portrait. That's a kind of dangerous thing to say.
It is kind of dangerous. I think you have to, in a way, expand your idea of what self-portrait means. But how we write, how we paint, I mean, I don't paint, but, you know, by extension, they're the products of our mind and our sensibility. So I think that they're self-portraits in that way. Our choices, our abilities.
Right. My tone will not be yours.
Exactly.
However, I just always rush in to say it's fiction, but for the feelings. It's all fiction but for the feelings, because I have to put that dimension on, or we don't want to be psychoanalyzed.
Well, I think that's true. I just think that our products, you know, they're products of our psyches.
No doubt.
And they're choices of our psyches, or of our, you know, even our intentions. So I see them as self-portraits in that way.
I like what you said before. It is our idea of what a self-portrait is.
Yes.
That is quite different.
Has to be enlarged.
It's not a photograph.
No.
No.
No, and it's not a direct representation. It's if you take all of somebody's work, then you have a real
self-portrait.
You
really have a voice.
You have a voice, yes.
And we're going to hear more from a Go figure. Carol Muldall is the author of 6 previous books of poetry and the winner of the Field Poetry Prize from Oberlin College. And she's been translated into Turkish and has bilingual editions in Istanbul, which used to be Constantinople. And Etruscan Press has put out her novella. She's received a Merwin Conservancy Artist Residency, an NEA Creative Writing Fellowship, which is very competitive, and Goodbye National Endowment for the Arts, Alanin Foundation Fellowship, Pushkar Prize, and she's been in every prestigious journal that we can say. What is the Turkish collection? She's been translated into Chinese, Italian, Portuguese, and Spanish, and forthcoming a volume into Chinese. What's the Turkish thing?
Well, the Turkish thing, I have a chapbook in English called Through the Window, and it's a linked series of, I guess, love poems or unrequited love poems. And the Turkish volume is that chapbook.
And how did you connect to Turkish people?
You know, so much of many of these things are serendipity.
Oh, right.
So for years I lived 20 miles north of Santa Fe, and one of my neighbors was she's since passed away, a wonderful high school teacher named Marianne Williams. And Mary Lou Williams. I don't think I've ever met anyone who's influenced so many of her students as she has. And she taught constitutional law, you know, history, but constitutional history. And she had done some exchange program in Turkey and sent my work to a fellow professor there.
You couldn't plot that.
No, exactly.
So we just have to release everything and trust. Yes. That it will fall on the right, an arrow in the arrow all the time.
Yes, so.
Let's have more from Go Figure, Carol Muldall.
So I thought I would read Raccoons.
You have a lot of critters around your house.
I do. Though this is more about two poets cohabitating than as much as the critters. Raccoons. On my way to water the strawberries at dusk, I gardened in those days. I saw a raccoon clasping the outdoor spigot like a sailor's wheel, using both paws that seemed more and more like hands as it kept twisting until water gushed out of the copper nozzle and it drank. I hadn't thought of it in years, not even after I saw another raccoon high-stepping the coyote fence midday with a limp vole overhanging its mouth. Such a singular sight, I had to tell you, and blurted it out as soon as I saw you, a piece of domestic gossip like the first crocus or noisy neighbors, common property like so much in marriage, a small business, a friend called it, down to the cooked books. Only later, after I spotted the raccoon sauntering through a line in one of your poems, only after the pressure cooker of my displeasure caused you to recast your raccoon and vole as skunk and mole, did I flash on the one I'd seen decades before. Its lack of furtiveness, the air it had of being within its rights, the way it took its time to retrace its steps to turn the water off. Or did it amble on and let the water run? No copyright protects idle talk, you might have said, or the imaginarium of marriage knows no bounds.
Boy, there's a lot going on in that one. Imaginarium, I had to look it up. I never had heard that before.
I was so happy that word came to
That's
me.
That's a beauty. Yeah. But no one can own another one's imaginarium. Can
no,
they?
No.
You can't own another one's dream, can you?
No, you can't put bounds on somebody's imaginary.
That's what I liked so much about this. It's very, it has a layer about human conduct,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I really, and it's so interesting that the dexterous raccoon, you didn't remember until an emotion floated right. it to the top.
That's right. I think that's so often the case, at least with me.
I really like that. That gives people the idea of what the hydraulic is under the poem, because we have this database inside. We can't get to it by willing it.
Yeah.
But the emotion brought it up.
Yes. And writing this poem, choreographing how the time went, you know, having the early raccoon described in the beginning and then coming back to it, that was complicated, finding out the best way to. I always think the sequence of how the sequence of information is given in a poem is important.
Well, you always have a water change in your poem, so it's very thoughtful.
Yeah.
So you do design it.
Yes, this poem went through many drafts. The early ones were more straightforward in time sequencing.
Okay, now my favorite poem, which I have to say, she doesn't have arthritis anymore.
Well,
but this is my favorite poem.
I do, but I don't have it to the degree that this
poem... Well, this isn't a complaint. We'll just tell them that.
Okay, arthritis. Save your hands, my mother says, seeing me untwist a jar's tight cap, just the way she used to tell me not to let boys fool around or feel my breasts. Keep them fresh for marriage, as if they were actual fruit. I scoff to think they could bruise, scuff, soften, rot, wither. I look down now at my knuckly thumbs, my index finger permanently askew in the same classic crook as hers, called a swan's neck, as if snapped, it's that pronounced. Even as I type, wondering how long I'll be able to, each joint in my left hand needing to be hoisted, prodded into place, one knuckle like a clock style clicking as it's turned to open, bend or unbend. I balk at the idea that we can overuse ourselves, must parcel out and pace our energies so as not to run out of any necessary component while still alive. The definition of necessary, necessarily, suffering change over time. The only certainty is uncertainty, I thought I knew, so ignored whatever she said about boys and sex, her version of a story, never mine. It made me laugh the way she made up traditions, that we didn't kiss boys until a certain age, we didn't fool around. What we? What part of me was she? No part I could put my finger on. How odd then, one day, to find her half napping in her room, talking first to herself and then to me about a boy she used to know, her friend's brother, who she kissed, she said, just because he wanted her to. Now why would I do that, she mused, distraught anew and so freshly stung by the self-betrayal. I reached across the gulf my father left to her side of their bed and stroked my future hand.
Terrific ending.
Thank
Terrific.
You.
I never saw a poem I couldn't take the last line off of except that one. That's really, what I really liked was the relationship and how it was clothed in the story. But beneath that, you really get a portrait of how two people are together.
Yes.
And I talked about a sea change in your work, and there you go again. You know, one, we're on one level, and then all of a sudden it goes to another level. So that I admired very much, although it just sounds like a story.
Right. I'm happy you see it. It is more than a story to me. And I always think that writing a poem, I experience writing a poem as a process of discovery, sometimes self-discovery. So when you say there's a sea change, that makes me very happy because the discovery
is unconscious.
Yeah.
But also, I'm your mother's age, probably.
A little younger, but in the same generation.
Yes, and I understand her Victorian attitude that, you know, you just didn't do that and you just didn't do that. And that is, so it was just common lexicon. in the 50s.
Right.
You know, and so that is kind of a memory poem for me. I liked it a lot.
That's nice.
And then I asked you to read a subsequent poem that was also on page 42.
Yes, on the cusp.
Because it's very, it has ethos.
On the cusp. Don't forget me, she pleads, just as she's quavering on the cusp of forgetting me. She utters my birth time, our shared moment of severing, my astrological starting point, like a secret code, a charm, the combination needed to open her built-in wall safe. The gears grind. When she gets the time wrong, I correct her, though I know I shouldn't. She wants her daily horoscope read aloud. Cancer, our mutual birth sign. What she says she did wrong doesn't match what I think, but I let all that go. She did nothing wrong. Look how we turned out. Aren't we your proof? Don't forget me, she repeats, 909.
Yeah, you know, the regret thing. So you forgave everything.
Yes. I mean, my mother, who's still living, has Alzheimer's.
Oh.
And there's just a point where you do, I think you, and in a way to grow up, you need to forgive everything, don't you?
And yourself.
And oneself,
for sure. I like that a lot. I wanted people to get a substantive taste of your voice without me interrupting you, so I'm going to ask you to read two together.
Okay. So Richter's song to start, I think. There it is. Richter's scale. It's funny to misname my own title. Richter's scale. If this were a crowdsourced blueprint for the resistance, it would tell you what action to take, but it won't. It can't. Isn't, I'm afraid, built that way. It wants instead to daydream, to remember a sunset when a bevy of deer vogued in the meadow, all looking up at the same time while grazing, all five tilting their heads at the same angle, their tails held up like rattles about to twitch. I scroll news the way my father followed stocks, sensitive to the smallest tremor. A seismograph, a lie detector needle, my pen, its doodles on the scratch pad. In slow motion, who can tell which way things will fall? History in real time. The deer scatter when I blink. And this is scavengers. One by one, six or seven ravens settle on the polished rim of our front courtyard's bowl-cut stone fountain. They cool their claws in the overflow, pecking at the placid water, a hint of gurgle at its center. From the window, I see them convening, conversing, but can't see why a flock is called an unkindness. To get at that, I'd have to be out among the carrion. When they leave, they lift off in one great rustle snap.
Quite a contrast, that last line, with the meaning. Yes. And I'm interested in your novella, which I didn't know you had written one. I'm going to rush home and get it. And tell us about it and how you went your way through it and why.
All right. Well, it's called The Widening. And it's a poetic novella, I guess you'd say. Each chapter is one paragraph, almost like a vignette. And it's in two parts that kind of mirror each.
Well, it's a prose poem.
Well, it is a novel, but it's a lyrical novel, I guess. And you know, probably plot, you know, in a traditional plot sense, isn't its greatest strength. It's kind of a character portrait, and the first half follows a teenage girl as she is first in boarding school and then traveling in Spain, and the second half is tracks her first year in college, and it's a coming of age story, mm-hmm. and it centers in a kind of in your face way or close up way. Maybe in your face isn't quite right because it is lyrical, on teenage female sexuality, which I think isn't portrayed that often from a girl's point of view. And it's very much from her point of view. And
why is that important?
Oh, I think it's very important. I think that, you know, first of all, female experience is probably underexplored in general. Maybe there's a counter argument to that, but
no, you're quite right.
Yeah, and I think you know, girls experience, you know, it's so easy to, as a girl, as a woman, to experience from the outside, and that's part of what, you know, with the duality when I am writing about art, it's a similar thing, and I think it's very important to experience the female experience
well,
from the inside.
I think it sounds like a contribution.
Well, thank you.
How many pages is it?
Oh, gosh, I haven't, you know, maybe it's 150 or something.
Fair dinkum novel.
It could be less. I can't. And I'm thrilled because it came out in 2008. And for its 20th anniversary, I believe Etruscan Press is going to reissue it.
That's an honor.
So
I'm. They don't always do that.
No,
they must have sold a few copies.
I don't know.
Okay. And now a final poem.
Well, I think I'll read the final poem in the book, which is called Meditation in the Open Air Garage. Leaves have no choice but to articulate the wind. Aspens like zills, a glint and a tilt. The willow, a lone zither. Riffling the cottonwoods at dusk, winds find me cushioned against the concrete in the open-air garage, facing the trees, the drive, the road, the mountains up the canyon's other side, until an onrush bellows a mindless, heartless ecstasy through the empty sack of me.
The voice of Carol Moldau. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and we're in the studios of the library. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by MAT Studios, Mike Turpin. We wish to thank our funders, the Sinipid Fund, the Rivada Foundation, Natalie Canavore, Avi Day Shoshani, Young Ki Kim Renault, Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Sandy Kinlock. I'm Grace Cavalieri.